The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled The Immunosurge Continues, Moving in Leaps and Bounds to Expand the Role and Impact of Immunotherapy in Metastatic, Locally Advanced, and Early Stage Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/JSU860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Thank you for joining us for the Immunosurge Continues, Moving in Leaps and Bounds to Expand the Role of Impact of Immunotherapy in Metastatic, Locally Advanced, and Early Stage Lung Cancer. I want to welcome today's faculty. I'm Sandeep Patel, Professor of Medical Oncology at the University of California, San Diego. Dr. Cascone?
Good morning, everyone. I'm Tina Cascone, Thoracic Medical Oncologist at University of Texas, MD Anderson.
I'm John Hamack, Chair of Thoracic Head and Neck Medical Oncology at MD Anderson Cancer Center.
And we have wonderful faculty today to be discussing all the advances in immunotherapy that have started in the metastatic setting and now have moved on into the curative intent setting. And so our goals for today are to enhance the understanding of the latest data on immunotherapies in stage 4, stage 3 unresectable, and stage 1 through 3 resectable non-small cell lung cancer, to augment skills in integrating immunotherapies into individualized treatment plans for patients with non-small cell lung cancer throughout the disease continuum, and then to implement best practices for multidisciplinary collaboration to make the most of immunotherapy advances and improve patient outcomes in non-small cell lung cancer. Let's start with immunotherapies in the metastatic setting, picking the winning card. And so since 2016, it's been a whirlwind of approvals for the benefit of our patients involving immunotherapy, biomarker-selected chemo-IO. And you notice a couple trends. The understanding that patients with EGFR and ALK are better served by targeted therapy, as well as the development of combinations, both in terms of addition of chemotherapy to immunotherapy, but also immunotherapy doublets, as we see here with the advent of CTLA-4 blockade-based frontline regimens. And so let's start with a case to better understand our practice patterns. This is a patient, a 69-year-old gentleman, quit smoking 30 years ago and is found to have a 3.4-centimeter right middle lobe lung mass on a coronary calcium scan. PET-CT revealed a 3.4-centimeter mass, with right hilar subcranial adenopathy, with PET avidity in the L1 spine, 12th rib, and left scapular metastases. MRI of the brain was negative for metastasis, ECOG 0, and really just has mild upper back pain. EBIS was performed based on this imaging and showed both poorly differentiated carcinoma with glandular and squamous features, a patchy positive TTF1, a negative NAPSIN P40, with a KRAS G13D delta mutation, and a PD-L1 score of 60%. Tina, what do you think when you look at this case? How would you handle this in your clinic?
Yeah, so thank you, Sandeep. So this is a very common scenario that we encounter in our clinic. This is a gentleman with an excellent performance status and unfortunately a diagnosis of a metastatic lung cancer, specifically a poorly differentiated lung cancer with mixed glandular and squamous features. It's interesting to see the molecular profiling with a KRAS G13D, as well as a high PD-L1 tumor proportion score of 60%. Given the fact that this patient is not that symptomatic with mild back pain, and overall the tumor burden seems to be not particularly robust, I feel that this could be a case that we could handle with a first-line immunotherapy, monotherapy. And if the tumor burden was higher or he had, more symptoms, we could combine immunotherapy. But as you showed us in your overview of the approvals and the options that we have available, I think we have several trials at this point that have demonstrated really good responses, incredibly encouraging overall survival with immunotherapy in the monotherapy setting with pembrolizumab, with cemiplimab, and with atezolizumab. So at this point, I would go ahead with monotherapy. We also know from the EMPOWER trials that patients treated with cemiplimab with the additional chemotherapy do very well. So that could be really a type of approach that I would endorse here.
Absolutely, Tina. John, what do these discussions look like in clinic? And let's say this patient was a little more symptomatic. Would you consider chemotherapy? And if so, what chemotherapy backbone may you consider with this histology?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, I consider a couple of different axes, in terms of categorizing patients here for immunotherapy. So as Sandeep mentioned, one of them is how symptomatic they are. Now, it's worth noting this was detected on a coronary calcium scan. So this is not somebody who presented symptomatically. And as Tina mentioned, the tumor bulk here is pretty modest. This is really somebody who's oligometastatic. So, you know, I hear this is not somebody who urgently is threatening compression of an airway, you know, or has some vital structure that's really being threatened. And again, with the PD-L1, so I'd sort of characterize in terms of the urgency, this is somebody where you've got time to see if you can have something respond and has a relatively high likelihood of responding, given that PD-L1 of 60%. You know, one piece of data we don't have here are the co-mutations that go along with KRAS. But in the setting of a PD-L1 greater than 60%, I'm not sure the co-mutations are going to be as important. So I agree that PD-1 monotherapy would be a reasonable choice. But if somebody were more symptomatic here, you know, I'd usually use a carbo-pem backbone. And with PD-L1 greater than 60%, I usually don't consider CTLA-4 blockade. You know, the data that we have for patients with PD-L1 greater than 50% says CTLA-4 is not going to be as helpful there.
No, great points and an important reminder in thinking about not only single biomarkers, but the biomarkers as really a constellation and contextualize. And the PD-L1 is only informative in and of itself when we have the genomics simultaneously. And so really, we have multiple immune monotherapy options here with pembrolizumab, atezolizumab, cemiplimab, as well as combinatorial options. And to John's point, the data for CTLA-4 in PD-L1 greater than 50% generally adds toxicity with not much benefit. As we're looking at these options, what sways you to use one regimen over another? And what's the biomarker testing strategy at your institution? Maybe Tina, I can start with you on this one.
Yeah, for sure. So I'll take the second one first. So for us, in terms of biomarker testing, we tend to be very diligent across the disciplines. So whoever sees the patient first, if we are looking at a resectable setting, here we are specifically in the metastatic setting. So our entire group, thoracic medical oncology, will place an NGS-based institutional testing on the tissue, as well as an NGS-based liquid biopsy. Many times we do see the patient while the samples are still being retrieved, and so the liquid biopsy always helps, and the turnaround time is quicker. So it's definitely something that can help in deciding the treatment strategy as we go. As far as option, I think for the monotherapy, I would prefer here the pembrolizumab. The semiplimab is also a very reasonable option. We've talked about the three trials, right? The Keynote 24, the Empower 110, and then the Empower Lung 3. As far as the combinational options, if we need to get to that point, a backbone of a platinum-based chemotherapy, if there are squamous features, perhaps we would also consider, a taxane or a therapy that we know is effective in the squamous histology. And then as John mentioned, for the non-squamous histology, we tend to use a pemetrexed combined with platinum. We talked about the dual immune checkpoint, when probably appropriate in presence of commutation. Here we are with PD-L1, 60%. And as far as the anti-angiogenic agents, these are also very reasonable options to implement with the backbone of chemoimmunotherapy. But this will be pretty much our algorithm.
Great points. John, would a PD-L1 score of 90% differ in terms of how you think about monotherapy versus combinatorial options in a symptomatic patient? And how do patient-related factors influence your treatment selection?
Yeah, this is in a symptomatic patient, you said? Or
let's say a symptomatic patient. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think we know PD-L1 is a continuous score, and the higher it is, the greater the likelihood of response is going to be. So I think the relative importance of adding chemotherapy from my perspective is, how high is the likelihood of response to PD-1 monotherapy, and how urgently do you or quickly do you need the response? PD-L1 at 90%, in my experience, responses are pretty quick typically. So I would still be okay with monotherapy. Even for somebody who's mildly symptomatic, I mean, I would have the discussion with them, but again, responses can be pretty robust in that setting. If they're symptomatic, there's also one other discussion that, isn't listed here, but for somebody who's oligometastatic like this, just had a rib med and had that primary mass and a little mediastinal adenopathy, is after you give initial induction therapy, do you consider consolidating with radiation as well. And that's a tricky one. You know, we've done studies before immunotherapy suggesting that's beneficial. Certainly, if this were a stage three, you know, it's something we would do. And you know, here this is not, it's only a metastasis away from, a single metastasis away from being a stage three. On the other hand, we don't yet have the randomized data with immunotherapy that supports that. You know, there's a cooperative group study, the LU002, that didn't go on to the second half of the study. The first part of it was negative. So I think the jury's out yet as to whether we should routinely give everybody consolidative radiation in this setting. I think, an important answered question. But right now, I'd be comfortable with PD-1 monotherapy. And I have equipoise with pembro, atezo, and cemiplimab. I think the data is reasonable for all three of them.
Great points, and really shows how much the field has changed, right? Instead of debating which chemotherapeutic derived from which U-tree makes the most sense, we have a dozen options in the IO setting, probably close to two dozen options in the targeted therapy setting, and many choices for how we can best help our patients. But let's go on to our second case. This is a patient, a 57-year-old smoker, who presented to the ER with a one-month history of progressive confusion. MRI showed a 3-centimeter frontal lobe metastasis, for which the patient had symptoms, the confusion, and went to neurosurgery. Pathology on that specimen showed adenocarcinoma, TTF positive, with a KRAS G12C mutation. STK11 KEAP1 co-mutations here were detected. PD-L1 was negative, and a CT scan for staging showed a large left lung lesion eroding into the left chest wall, right rib metastasis. He's recovered from his neurosurgery. He has some comorbidities related to COPD and coronary artery disease. All right, and so this is a slightly different case, patient with brain metastasis, has co-mutations. John, how do you think about this patient, PD-L1 negative?
Yeah, so this is a different scenario for several reasons, and obviously we've got, I think, a very sophisticated audience here in terms of how they're approaching this. So first of all, it's a G12C mutation, and I think the answer that we give here today is likely to be different than the answer we give here probably about a year or two from now. You know, I think we know there's a number of clinical studies for G12C inhibitors combined with immunotherapy or combined with chemoimmunotherapy. We're hoping those are going to, you know, be positive. So we may have different options a year or two from now in the first line setting. But with the data that we have in our hand right now, G12C inhibitors are approved in the second line setting, and the response rates, I think, justify that position. PD-L1 mutant patients, we know, get less benefit from chemotherapy and PD-1 inhibition. And this is really where I think CTLA-4 has a well-established role. You know, and if you take a look at the data, and here we've got two regimens where you've got chemotherapy and dual immune checkpoint blockade. We've got Poseidon and we've got the 9LA regimen. And the data we have supports, in the PD-L1 negative patients, that's where we see a greater relative benefit for the addition of CTLA-4 to PD-1, as compared to, for example, the higher PD-L1, where I think CTLA-4 adds relatively less benefit. The other dimension here is that they explicitly mentioned the patient has STK11 and KEAP mutations. Now, the impact of these co-mutations is interesting and notable. They both have a prognostic effect, so it's not surprising that the patient has brain metastasis. Both of those alterations are associated with a greater likelihood of brain metastasis. But they have not only a prognostic effect, they have a predictive impact as well. So it looks like, you know, in several lines of data support this, if you've got these mutations, you also get greater relative benefit from adding CTLA-4 blockade. So highly symptomatic, so I add chemotherapy. PD-L1 negative and the co-mutations, STK11 and KEAP, I think both of those support the addition of CTLA-4 blockade. So I agree with the audience here. I would pick a chemotherapy plus dual ICI regimen.
Tina, what are your thoughts, and how would you get the molecular result in this case? Is it more likely to be from tissue, liquid, and how would you handle that result?
Yeah, we are fortunate enough here to have a resected brain metastasis, so that should be appropriate for, you know, comprehensive tissue-based molecular profiling, which, you know, is always the choice if we have the opportunity. But as I mentioned, as the molecular profiling on tissue is being performed, the liquid biopsy is something that always helps us to get the ball rolling. And I agree 100% with the dual ICI, so PD-1, PD-L1, CTLA-4 inhibition plus the chemotherapy. I think we're all excited to see that prospective trials are being launched, right, to specifically test this combination in patients with metastatic lung cancer, including those with PD-L1 negative disease.
Absolutely. And so an opportunity for us to use multiple tools in our arsenal of chemotherapy, which we know, anti-CTLA-4 blockade and anti-PD-1, PD-L1 directed therapy to benefit this patient. Immunotherapies in stage 3 unresectable non-small cell lung cancer, deciphering the best multimodal approach. There's probably no area in non-small cell lung cancer that's undergone such rapid development of new therapeutic strategies than in the stage 3 setting. This is the AJCC8 criteria. We'll actually be on the AJCC9 soon. And some of the key features when we think about a patient are their tumor, the size of the primary, their nodal involvement, and an metastasis. And so as the criteria evolve, thinking about single station versus multi-station is one of the areas in which we'll see some changes in staging. And so, Tina, as we're thinking about a patient with stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer, which is a very heterogeneous group, how do you handle these discussions in clinic, at tumor board, and multidisciplinary clinic? And what are the factors that may influence you towards a concurrent chemo-RADS followed by immunotherapy approach versus a neoadjuvant versus adjuvant versus perioperative surgical approach?
Yes, absolutely. Well, I'm very glad to see here really the multidisciplinary patient assessment planning and support on the slide, because those elements are really paramount in how we really manage this patient. So in the locally advanced unresectable setting, we would discuss the patient not only in the weekly tumor board, but also in what we call the multidisciplinary clinics. And those are extremely valuable because in the same day and in the same setting, the patient has the opportunity to see the specialties, the thoracic medical oncology, the surgeons, and the radiation oncologist. These factors, so patient factors and tumor factors are relevant in these conversations. Definitely the performance status of our patients, the comorbidities, especially if we think about the combined concurrent chemoradiation therapy, followed by a consolidation therapy that can be, of course, the immunotherapy, or as we will see with results hopefully coming up soon for targeted therapies with the LoRa in terms of EGFR mutation and so forth. I think that those elements are absolutely, indispensable for making our decisions. As far as the resectable versus not resectable, these are conversations that we have to have, of course, in the tumor board with our surgeons. We've been fortunate to see over the past few years really a transformation with single and multi-station and two. Many of the trials assessing chemo immunotherapy in the neoadjuvant and in the adjuvant setting has have definitely included these patients. I think the molecular profiling is something that, as I was mentioning, is absolutely necessary as we decide how we continue treatment in the consolidation setting after concurrent chemoradiation.
Great point, Tina. John, how do these discussions look like in your clinic, and what genes are you specifically looking for in this setting?
Yeah, well, so first of all, I just wanted to, agree with the points Tina made about these discussions. And I'd say these discussions have really changed in the last couple of years. And there are also wide variations between institutions. I mean, just different institutions I've been at, particularly around this area of resectability. You know, it'd be nice to say, well, we have unresectable and resectable disease. And I think when we, categorize it, we'll say, okay, this is a patient who's unresectable or resectable. The variations even among institutions, among highly skilled and highly specialized surgeons is still really wide. I can mention I've been at institutions where they routinely gave chemo radiation first and then did surgeries afterwards. And then I've been in institutions where they say, bottom line, you never operate on somebody who has multi-station N2 disease. But on the other hand, when we look at our recent neoadjuvant and adjuvant studies, and we'll discuss some of these later, actually in those studies, half of patients had N2 disease, And a significant percentage of those that underwent resection had multi-station M2 disease. So I think that there's an important bullet here. There's two separate questions. Is something technically resectable? And is it a good idea to resect it? And those are really two separate discussions. And the latter question, you know, is it a good idea, is something that's really shifting as we get, immunotherapy in here. Now, to your question of what genes do we look at, you know, I think here, from my perspective, a key one is, do they have a driver oncogene where we've got a TKI? And, how you handle a TKI, I think, is really an open question. I mean, we're excited now that we've got the LORA results that we're going to be seeing soon, and we've at least heard that they're positive, I think, as is widely anticipated. But how we handle locally advanced disease with driver oncogenes is going to be a wide open area. We're going to spend a lot of time settling. But at least if we know they don't have a driver oncogene, we can put them in this other bucket, that we handle as well. So those are our considerations. But it's this issue of resectability, especially around N2 diseases, it really is a moving target.
Yeah.
Ask in San Diego, how do those discussions go, and what's the willingness of surgeons there to resect N2 disease?
Yeah, and it varies, and a lot of it depends on patient factors as well. And so the longest discussions we'll have in our clinic are around stage 3 nowadays, and a tumor board as well. Single station or multi station, if they're referred from outside, do they have adequate mediastinal staging, which is something we may have to repeat sometimes to have a better understanding. But basically for a fit patient, the Nadim data, the CheckMate A16 data, across all these studies, 671, stage 3 patients seem to do the best with either neoadjuvant perioperative approaches. And so I think nodal station may not matter as much in the era of IO, but I think we'll continue to see those options. But they're very, these discussions used to be much simpler 5 years ago, but now we have a lot of complexity that belies the efficacy of these novel approaches. And so it's a great discussion on what I think is probably the most active area in our clinics.
Perhaps please. I can add one element that, in our willingness to really provide the patients with all the possible options in a multidisciplinary approach, especially now that we have this plethora of agents really that, have paved the way and have changed completely how we treat resectable and unresectable. I think we need to keep in mind that in addition to the anatomical and functional factors, the preferences of our patients are very important. So as John mentioned, discussing at length with, our patients, what that treatment strategy, that approach would that entail, their supporting system, their financial situation, that's something that we need to keep in mind in the multidisciplinary team as we streamline the final treatment options. So I just wanted to emphasize that.
It's a great point, and making sure they meet everyone on the team, not only for their own clinic visits, but us in our discussions and understanding the type of surgical operation approach that may be appropriate. And so let's talk about probably the initial foray of immunotherapy into localized curative intent non-small cell lung cancer was the PACIFIC study. We're all aware folks with stage 3 unresectable non-small cell lung cancer got concurrent chemo radiation followed by a year of durvalumab versus placebo. And we see here now up to 5-year data and beyond, really, a sustained benefit, the order about 10%, up to 4 years, right, after the last dose of treatment. And many of us have patients that have undergone this treatment and continue to do well. When we look at the data from PACIFIC, a couple questions that pop up. One is around molecular testing. I think LORA may obviate the need for discussions around some of these EGFR subsets as we move forward. But one thing that came up was around PD-L1 expression. Now, in my clinic, I tend to use durvalumab independent because this is a post-hoc analysis. But curious, is PD-L1 something that informs your clinical practice? Maybe Tina, I could start with you on this one.
I think, I echo what you just mentioned. I with this data in mind, I still don't tend to use PD-L1 tumor proportion score as a really an element to direct therapy in this setting. I would provide the patients with the durvalumab if there are not genomic aberrations for which a trial would be appropriate. But definitely this is something that we have to keep in mind.
John, is that your approach as well?
Yeah, I don't use it for the initial decision, except insofar as PD-L1 is sometimes a surrogate for a driver oncogene. And if a tumor is less than 1% and somebody's a non-smoker, for example, you wonder if there's a driver oncogene there. And that's really where, I give it additional thought, you know, because sometimes, you know, you have a question, is something really a stage three, or there's a little nodule, you're not sure if it's a metastasis there. And finding a driver oncogene is what will often push me to a different direction in this setting. So I think I care more about the driver oncogenes than the PD-L1 per se. But I think the trend is, you know, it is pretty clear, even though it's a post-hoc analysis there, that those patients likely get less benefit.
Absolutely. And not a lot of tissue to make the PD-L1 assessment on either. And so there are a variety of trials that are looking at either concurrent, sequential, in IO with radiotherapy. We see a variety of these studies here. This represents a standard of care for many of our clinics. Let's move on to discuss a different patient case. This is a 65-year-old female with left upper lobe adenocarcinoma found on with a vascular and pericardial evasion on CT. She underwent a PET scan with PET avidity in these lesions, and the FNA showed poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma. EBIS was performed with a 4L and 7 positive lymph node for adenocarcinoma, 4R was negative. The biomarker profile was PD-L1 negative, KRAS G12C with an ATM mutation, TMB 9.5 mutations per megabase, and so T4N2. This is what the imaging looked like. Sean, maybe can you walk us through how you think about a patient in terms of resectable versus conversion therapy versus a concurrent chemorads patient?
Yeah, you know, I'll say that I shared the indecision of the crowd here about how to approach this. And I feel like every tumor board, we have a debate that's just like this. You know, so in the perioperative studies and in the neoadjuvant studies, it explicitly said that the patient had to be considered surgical at the time of initial evaluation. So the therapy wasn't to convert somebody from inoperable to operable for those studies. So when we look at the data from any of the perioperative or neoadjuvant studies, you know, that, part of the metric isn't, did you convert somebody, to operable? So, you know, so we, you know, commonly say, okay, well, consider whether they'd be operable right now. On the other hand, you know, every tumor board, we have a discussion and say, well, what if we really shrunk this tumor, you know, a good amount? Do you think it might come off the vessel? You might get rid of that invasion and this person might become operable, and if so, you know, would you be able to get it? I think we think of that, you know, as aspirationally resectable, you know, if they have a great response. And then we'll often weigh in, well, what are the comorbidities? How young, how well could they, you know, potentially tolerate that? How aggressive do they want to be? And so forth. So I think the most standard answer here for somebody with vascular invasion would be definitive chemorads followed by durvalumab. But I'd say we often do consider, you know, especially if we think the likelihood of response is pretty good, you know, do we give them a shot to become operable if you really did have a good response?
Absolutely. Tina, how are these discussions in your clinic, and is the type of surgical approach, pneumonectomy versus lobectomy, for example, influence your decision-making here?
Yes. So first of all, I completely agree with what John mentioned. I want to add that we will finally have, in the context of clinical trials, an approach that is being tested for patients who are unresectable or borderline unresectable. So in a prospecting setting now, we will be able to see, can we convert safely and make an unresectable patient resectable? As far as the discussion in the clinic, I think it's absolutely necessary to engage the multidisciplinary team. And, you know, if the patient is potentially resectable, especially with our surgeons, please keep in mind that in the neoadjuvant chemoimmunotherapy, immunotherapy era, it's absolutely necessary that our surgeons are very well familiar with maneuvers that are appropriate in this setting. I think education over the past few years across all the disciplines in the multidisciplinary team has definitely done a lot. I think John can agree with me, we are fortunate to really see every resectable patient, even with stage two. So our surgeons are very much of the mindset of do not just take the patient to the operation room, but have this multidisciplinary discussion to potentially implement a neoadjuvant treatment, even for a patient that perhaps a few years ago would just go to upfront surgery.
Absolutely, and great points. And so Conversion therapy is still only in the context of clinical trials. The resectability is determined when you meet the patient. And so, and I think we alluded to this earlier. We saw the top level press release around LAURA, the adjuvant osimertinib study following concurrent chemo radiation for unresectable stage 3 patients. So I think many of us are really excited to see this data because the alternatives in terms of immunotherapy for this patient population have left much to be desired. And B, many of us have seen how effective osimertinib can be in the stage 3 postoperative setting. And so thinking about radiation there. And so there are multiple biomarker testing needs in localized non-small cell lung cancer. I think for us, this is a challenge because many times these patients get EBIS. They're making their initial diagnosis. You're doing genomics. There's not a lot of tissue left. These are some of the mutations we're thinking about in terms of localized non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer. Any that you'd like to see? Is STK-KEAP1 a nice to have and need to have? Are EGFR, ALK, PD-1, PD-L, the big three? Tina, what do you think?
I think if there is the opportunity to have a comprehensive profiling, that's always the standard because it will also help us to make decisions in the next steps for our patients in terms of availability of clinical trials. And so forth. So ideally, and again, being an institution where we have that opportunity, I feel very fortunate. But ideally, I tend to really have the NGS based with comprehensive profiling on all our patients, not only for the decision of consolidation durvalumab in this setting versus, you know, targeted therapy, whether there is an EGFR mutation. If we're in the resectable setting, we have the ADORA data, now we have the ALINA data, but we have several trials that are actually testing specific inhibitors matching with the specific drivers. So I think I would strongly recommend, if possible, to do a comprehensive profile.
Absolutely. And John, any biomarkers you'd like to see?
Yeah, you know, and here I'll disagree with Tina a little bit, or have a little different perspective in terms of the comprehensive panel or not. So I fully agree we would like markers. But here we're actually having debates with our molecular diagnostics group because I think the importance of rapid turnaround in the early stage setting and the locally advanced setting becomes even greater because, you know, in that setting, the pressure to get therapy started quicker is even greater if you've got somebody who's either potentially resectable or going to get chemo radiation. So we're in discussions about, instead of getting a giant panel, which we would love a giant panel quickly, but realistically, we would actually settle for a very small panel that could be turned around in a couple of days. And there are technologies out there that can get your EGFR, ALK, and a few other key driver oncogenes in a few days. And so for us, having the key drivers, because now I think you need EGFR, you need ALK in early stage resectable. The labels are likely to indicate that as well for using immunotherapy or, of course, the ADORA or ALINA regimens. So I'm hoping we can move to where the testing for earlier stage patients becomes not only routine but very rapid, so that patients are not forced to make a decision between getting the appropriate targeted therapy or getting something quickly. Because I can say often the pressure on patients, from family members or themselves, to just do something quickly leads to suboptimal decision making.
Absolutely. And so let's talk about immunotherapies in resectable stage 1-3 non-small cell lung cancer. Really an area, even at this meeting, we've seen there's been an advent of multiple therapies. CheckMate 816 was the initial study, 3 cycles of chemotherapy with nivolumab, followed by surgery. Then in the adjuvant studies, IMpower 10 and Keynote 91 are PEARLS. Those are post-operative regimens with chemo followed by immunotherapy for 1 year. And then the perioperative approach is where folks get chemotherapy and immunotherapy up front, followed by surgery, followed by a post-operative or adjuvant regimen for up to 1 year. And so when we talk about CheckMate 16, this is the first study to utilize neoadjuvant chemo IO. 3-arm study, though the bulk of the discussions are on nevo chemo versus chemo alone. EGFR ALK status, depending on the study, depending on what jurisdiction you were in, accruing was either mandated or recommended. Though I think in our practice, we all want to know what EGFR is, especially as we start to have other options in a localized setting, ADORA, for example, and LAURA upcoming. This showed a pathological complete response rate of 24%. I think one of the really innovative things about the study, above and beyond the setting, was utilizing pathologic CR and seeing how this correlates with the 3-year event-free survival, as we see here. Here are the immature overall survival trends at the 3-year update. And this is one of the most interesting things, I think, about the study was really how the introduction of immunotherapy, at least numerically, seemed to have almost a CNS protective effect in terms of distal recurrence, which is something very important for our patients with non-small cell lung cancer. Let's talk about some of the adjuvant studies that have been utilized in our clinical practice. Many times you see the patient after their surgery, right? And so you have to make the decision. Proper molecular profiling for EGFR and ALK at the very least would be recommended based on our the availability of targeted therapy options. IMpower 10 was one of the first studies to look at adjuvant immunotherapy with atezolizumab for 1 year following chemotherapy after surgery. This is disease-free survival according to PD-L1 expression with the most substantive improvement in PD-L1 greater than 50% and suggestions of improvement in greater than 1%. KEYNOTE-91 or the PEARL study, similarly, was post-operative adjuvant treatment with PD-L1 testing after chemotherapy. Pembrolizumab was administered independent of PD-L1 strata, less than 1%, 1 to 49, greater than 50%. For the overall population, we see here the disease-free survival with a hazard ratio of 0.76. And then for the greater than 50% hazard ratio of 0.82, which is somewhat paradoxical given the results of KEYNOTE-24 in the metastatic setting. And so let's move on to discussion of some of the perioperative approaches. And I'd like to invite John to carry away the discussion.
Okay. Well, so you've heard from Sandeep about the potential benefits of adjuvant therapy and neoadjuvant. So obviously the rationale for perioperative therapy is to combine the benefits from both to induce an immune response when the tumor is in place and the antigen burden is higher, but also have the benefits of sustained immunotherapy afterwards. So you'll see three different studies here with a similar perioperative design. The Aegean used durvalumab plus chemotherapy, followed by surgery, and then a year of durvalumab, as compared to just chemotherapy for 4 cycles, followed by surgery and then placebo. And again, you'll see similar designs with KEYNOTE-671 with pembrolizumab and 77T with nivolumab. Just a couple of points about the particular design. Here, initially, EGFR and ALK patients were included. But then after we got results from ADORA and after I think the data supported that EGFR and ALK patients could be treated by other means, the study was amended. So the primary analysis does not include EGFR or ALK. Now, we presented data already that said that group of patients, the EGFR mutant patients at least, did not get significant benefit from therapy here. So this is all an EGFR and ALK wild type. The other worth noting is that the surgery here had to be a planned lobectomy or bilobectomy or sleeve resection. So patients who were going to need a pneumonectomy up front were not included here as part of the eligibility. So the study had two primary endpoints. The first was EFS. The study was positive at the first possible interim analysis that was planned. So this one is relatively less mature than I think some of the other studies when it hit its positive result. So you can see here the hazard ratio for EFS was 0.68, about an 11% improvement in 2-year progression or EFS-free survival. And again, there'll be another interim analysis that comes out for these results in the near future. Study was also positive for the primary endpoint of pathologic complete response, and this is fully mature data. This is from the entire data set here. You see 17% versus 4%, and study was positive for major pathologic response as well, 33% versus 12%. So positive for both planned primary endpoints. And so this gives a sense for the treatment and the disposition. So about 80% of patients in both arms underwent surgery, 81%. And this is consistent with what we see with neoadjuvant studies. You know, we're typically 17 to 20% of patients don't end up undergoing surgery. By the way, in studies where patients are randomized to surgery right away, you still often get a significant percentage who don't end up undergoing surgery. The rates of R0 resection were actually slightly higher in the durvalumab arm. So the addition of durvalumab did not impact the ability to undergo surgery or undergo an R0 resection there as well. And from this, there was really a robust collection of circulating tumor DNA that was monitored both at baseline and then during treatment and then after resection. And some of this data has already been presented by Martin Reck and others at earlier in this. Martin presented this at ESMO. And so one of the really interesting findings, and I think it's consistent with what we expected might happen, is that ctDNA clearance is predictive of pathologic complete response and ultimately of benefit here. And it predicts it earlier than waiting for a surgical resection. So if you look here, this is looking at ctDNA clearance rate. So if this goes up, that means there's greater ctDNA clearance. And this is among patients who are positive at baseline. Now, it's worth noting, not everybody is positive from the very onset. And you can look here at patients who had a pathologic complete response, so the solid lines, and patients who did not have a pathologic complete response, there are the dashed lines. And you can see that there's immediately a separation in those curves by ctDNA. You can tell the group that had path CR or non-path CR. And by the end of cycle two, by cycle three, day one, if you've are destined to have a pathologic complete response, the likelihood of you having cleared your ctDNA was extremely high. If you are destined to not have a pathologic complete response, the likelihood that you've cleared your ctDNA is less than 40%. So this tells us ctDNA is clearly giving us an early readout of what we can expect at the time of surgical resection. And the same goes for a major pathologic response. So it really supports that ctDNA could be a useful marker here as well. All right, and this is the KEYNOTE-671 study. This is a similar design as AEGEAN, except with pembrolizumab. Patients with EGFR and ALK were not excluded. If they had known EGFR and ALK, then they were, but only about 3% of patients had known EGFR ALK. So molecular profiling before was not mandated. And again, four cycles or up to four cycles of therapy with pembrolizumab in either cisplatin or carboplatin-based regimens or gemcitabine for squamous. And then again, 1 year of pembrolizumab after surgery. So this study also hit its primary endpoint of EFS. You see here a hazard ratio of 0.59. And at that two-year rate, you can see a similar 62% or so were EFS-free. And here an impressive 20% improvement in the EFS-free rate at 2 years. So really making a significant improvement as compared to neoadjuvant chemotherapy alone in the likelihood of a recurrent disease. Pathologic response, again, also increased, similar to what we saw before, 18% versus 4%. We're consistently seeing about a 4% complete pathologic response from chemotherapy across the different arms. That's reassuring. That tells us we're looking at relatively similar populations. And major pathologic response, 30%. Versus 11%. So again, positive for EFS, positive for complete pathologic response. Now, the study is immature in terms of overall survival, but at the initial, at this interim analysis, or interim analysis number two, you can see a positive hazard ratio of 0.72 with the one-sided p-value of 0.005. So certainly a strong p-value that is absolutely going in the right direction here, especially considering that that the study is not mature for overall survival yet. So next for 77T, I'll turn this over to Tina.
Thank you, John. So I think John summarized very nicely the rationale of the perioperative approach and mentioned to you that the 77T is another kid on the block here in the perioperative setting. This is the perioperative trial that gets us closer to a comparison with the CheckMate 816, although we should never do cross-trial comparisons. The CheckMate 7070 tested the perioperative nivolumab, so neoadjuvant and adjuvant added to the backbone of platinum-based chemotherapy in the neoadjuvant setting. So as you can see here from the schema, four cycles of a nivolumab plus chemotherapy, followed by surgery and adjuvant nivolumab for 1 year, as compared to a neoadjuvant chemotherapy alone, followed by surgery and placebo. The population enrolled on trial, which was 461 overall, was made of patients with stage 2, 3B, so N2 single and multi-station resectable and medically operable and surgically resectable non-small cell lung cancer, of course, treatment naive, with no EGFR mutations or non-ALK alterations detected. So molecular profiling was mandated for enrollment. Two co-primary endpoints, EFS by Beaker, blinded independent central review, and multiple secondary endpoints, including the PCR and the MPR, which were both evaluated by blinded independent pathological review using the immune-related pathologic assessment criteria, which is an element of difference compared to the KEYNOTE-671 and the AEGEAN, where in both the ISLAC criteria were used. And also we have the OS and safety. And particularly for what has been presented at ESMO last year, a couple of exploratory analyses, the EFS by PCR and MPR status, as well as the EFS by adjuvant treatment status. And here we reported a follow-up, a median follow-up time of 25.4 months. So you can see here, this study met the primary, one of the two primary endpoints, the EFS per Beaker with perioperative nivolumab being superior to chemotherapy and placebo with an hazard ratio of 0.58. So overall, similar to what we've seen for the 671, which has a very similar median follow-up time. And as John mentioned, pretty confident with longer follow-up, the AEGEAN will have very similar results. So here we have a median EFS non-reached for the perioperative nivo and 18.4 months for the chemo placebo. Again, with an EFS of 1 year of 73% versus 59%, and again, then 20% improved rate here at 18 months. The censoring didn't allow us to go to 24 months yet, but as of the 18 months, you can see greater benefit, 70% versus 50%. With the experimental arm and the chemo arm, respectively. And the EFS per investigator assessment, which was utilized from other, in other trials, also favored the NIVO in the perioperative setting with an hazard ratio of 0.56. So here, the pathological complete response was achieved in 25.3% of patients versus 4.7% of patients with the chemo placebo. So overall, similar to what we've seen with the CheckMate 816 neoadjuvant nivo chemo utilizing identical pathologic assessment criteria. And the MPR was achieved in 35.4% of patients with neoadjuvant nivo as compared to 12.1% with a chemo. So this slide shows you a summary of the treatment and surgery disposition. I will not go through in detail, but I just want to point out that across the two arms, at least 85% of patients completed four cycles of neoadjuvant treatment, and 78% of patients in the nivo arm and 77% of patients in the chemo arm underwent definitive surgery. And you can see from the boxes on each respective side that disease progression was the most common reason for cancellation of surgery in both arms, but there were more cancellations in the chemo arms as compared to the nivo arm. Approximately 60-65% of patients in both arms received adjuvant treatment, which is pretty much what we have seen in the other perioperative trials. And I want to point out that study drug toxicity was the most common reason for not receiving adjuvant nivo, whereas disease progression was the most common reason for not receiving adjuvant placebo. And 60% of these patients who started adjuvant treatments overall, 30-40% of the initial denominator completed adjuvant therapy. And again, study drug toxicity was the most common reason for not completing 1 year of nivolumab, whereas disease progression was the most common reason for not completing placebo. As far as the initial surgical outcomes, lobectomy was performed in approximately 70-80% of patients between the two arms, whereas a pneumonectomy, which was allowed in this trial, as in the 671, was performed in 9% and 14% of patients in the perioperative nevo arm and the chemo arm, respectively. And a non-zero resection was achieved pretty much in 90% of patients in both arms.
But great. And really a great overview of all the recent updates and data in the neoadjuvant and perioperative space. And so to round it off, a final case, this is a 55-year-old gentleman, former smoker, 50-pack year smoking history, FEV1 about 58%, DLCO 90%, ECOG 1, had an asymptomatic 6-centimeter suprahilar mass detected. This is the PET imaging, so hot on PET. Brain MRI and PET otherwise clear. EBUS was performed, which had an 11R positive lymph node. So the tumor was in the upper lobe adenocarcinoma. The stage is T3N1. Biomarker testing was performed here, a limited panel, negative for EGFR and ALK and PD-L1 less than 1%. John, maybe I can start with you on this one. Which, as you look at this case, do you agree with what the audience thinks here, or would you have a different approach? Anything else you'd want to know?
Yeah, no, I agree with the audience on this one. You know, I think this patient clearly is at high risk, for recurrence. And even though the EBUS was negative, you know, you saw that that 4R node was lighting up a bit with that suprahilar location. This is somebody who clearly has, high risk of further mediastinal spread and potentially distant disease. So this, I think, is somebody I would strongly urge neoadjuvant chemoimmunotherapy for. Depending on the results, I mean, I believe then giving adjuvant, it would likely be beneficial as well.
Absolutely. Tina, how do you think about this case in your...
Yeah, so absolutely. This is someone who needs to be discussed, of course, at tumor board with our surgeons and pathology colleagues and radiation oncology colleagues. And if deemed resectable, as I don't feel there was a reason for a lack of resectability, this is definitely a patient that, as John mentioned, will benefit from at least to start a neoadjuvant chemoimmune-based approach for... 3 to 4 cycles. I think that we'll see coming up more data, right, in terms of any difference between 3 and 4 cycles. So sometimes it's difficult to put that 4 cycle in, and we're always concerned that we might preclude surgery. And the 816 with 3 cycles give us overall very comforting results. As far as the adjuvant phase, that's something that definitely I tend to discuss extensively with my patients. Looking at several factors, how they tolerated the treatment in the neoadjuvant setting, did they develop any treatment-related adverse events, specifically immune-related adverse events? We know that there is cumulative incidence if there is already an immune event that has happened. What are the social, factors? So looking at potential medical and financial toxicities. And PCR as a variable is something that perhaps we should look at as more of a percent viable tumor. And so what's the range? We have seen from the CheckMate 816 interesting data just published a few weeks ago in Nature Medicine on how patients who have a 0 to 5% residual viable tumor after 3 cycles of neoadjuvant chemo-nivo have an EFS at 2 years of 90%. And now that EFS drops really in alignment with the dropping of the percent viable tumor. But I agree with John. I would tend to continue immunotherapy if there are all these factors in place.
Absolutely. I would concur. And so this patient underwent neoadjuvant chemotherapy with immune checkpoint blockade, was taken to the OR. John, I'd love to hear how you're handling this in your clinic. For us, getting MRD testing is really in the context of a clinical trial currently. Is this something you're utilizing clinically, or how would you factor in these kind of dynamic biomarkers?
Yeah, so we're not using circulating tumor DNA to make the decision here. And I agree with the group on both. Now, I realize this is an issue that could formally be addressed in clinical studies. From my perspective, the notion of de-intensifying is less important than the notion of curing more people. So if you take the pathologic complete response rate group, we know they do much better overall. But in the exploratory analysis, both from KEYNOTE 671 and 77T, if you take the PATCR group, the one who had a PATCR with chemo did not do nearly as well as the PATCR with immunotherapy. They continued immunotherapy for a year. The hazard ratio there was 0.33, and it makes sense. The group that has responded so well to immunotherapy, why would you stop the immunotherapy? And the idea is, well, they're cured already. That actually is not true. So if you have a complete pathologic response, likely to recurrence is still over 20%, in the chemotherapy. So I would absolutely continue immunotherapy in that group. And the non-PATCR group, that group does worse overall, but there still looks like there's a benefit for the group that gets neoadjuvant and adjuvant immunotherapy. But that's really the group where we've got to figure out how to do something additional, to intensify them, because their likelihood of recurrence is so high. So I think the challenge for the field is, how do we do better with that non-PATCR group?
Absolutely. And Tina, what are your thoughts on that population?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And I want to add that this particular patient was a PD-L1 negative. And so with 816, we have seen definitely, a difference between the PD-L1 positive and especially the PD-L1 high and the PD-L1 negative. But in the perioperative setting, we've actually seen some trends towards, an improvement in, with an hazard ratio score probably 0.7, 0.73 across the trials for the PD-L1 negative population with a perioperative approach. And I also want to mention that for patients who completed adjuvant treatment, we have a couple of trials now that, again, in a purely exploratory type of approach, the NADIM-2 and the 77T, although we cannot tease out the contribution or components from any of this trial, have shown us that for patients who had an R0 resection and for patients who have completed the adjuvant portion of the study, there is a benefit from perioperative treatment for patients with a PCR for the 77T 0.22 as a ratio, and for patients without a PCR. So definitely continuing, and also for patients without a PCR, is something that we should keep in mind.
Great point. And I think these are actually several of the questions from our audience. Maybe to end, I'd like to get one thought from each of you, which relates to some of the questions we have around how can we best implement this in a community where a lot of oncology care is given, multiple tumor types are taken care of, perhaps the surgeon is doing as many vascular procedures as oncology procedures. What pearls can we offer to our colleagues in the community? Maybe I can start with John to give the last word.
Yeah, well, what I'd say, it really has become more of a multidisciplinary effort up front. I think before, and commonly still, I think in a lot of places, the paradigm is, well, if it's potentially resectable, surgeon first, then send to a medical oncologist. This really has to be getting the whole team involved in the beginning and getting molecular profiling done rapidly. Just, you see the enormous potential benefits of targeted therapy for the right patients in this setting too. So I think it really involves that multidisciplinary group, including molecular diagnostics, all doing their work right up front.
Absolutely. Tino, what are your thoughts and best advice for our community partners?
Yeah, I mean, I can't emphasize this enough. Education, and, and I'm a strong advocate of for the community physicians to reach out to us and, have that multidisciplinary approach also between the community and academic setting, because that definitely will improve the likelihood that we will tailor the best treatment strategies for our patients in the setting.
Absolutely. So I want to thank John and Tina for joining me on this discussion around immunotherapy approaches in the localized setting.
This activity is certified by PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education. Remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/JSU860. This activity is supported by an independent educational grant from AstraZeneca.